Crickle ward, you stole my youth away. For I was young and innocent, and you were old and grey.
Cor Corran, the columns of Alan Corran. Part 2, Suburban Fauna.
I have a pregnant goldfish. But don't write to congratulate me. Don't start knitting things. Such kindnesses will be premature. I have passed this way before. Every April, I stroll through the back garden, green shoots below, plump buds above, to check for consonant burgeonings in the pond, and sure enough, every year, one of my 2 dozen fish is duly swollen. It is with egg. It is not always the same fish, but let's not get sidetracked into why this should be, because before we know it, we shall find ourselves speculating as to what makes a fish attractive, what makes other fish fancy it one year but not the next, and what the complex social and sexual mores are, which obtain in 6 cubic yards of cricklewood water to ensure that only one female per annum ever, as my mother would have put it, falls. Having learned to tread warily in the semantics of modern feminism, I do not, of course, put it that way myself. I do not even know why my mother's generation put it that way. It seems a bit glum, but I don't intend to start rummaging through dictionaries. It's bad enough that my desk is piled high with ichthyological texts, these being what you lug home from the library if you want little fish. Because if you don't lug them home, you have no way of stopping what big fish want, which is little fish too, but they want them somewhat differently. They want to eat them. For fish are pedophagic. Worse yet, they do not gobble only other fish's offspring, they also gobble their own. Why they should have developed this repugnant habit is beyond me. Nothing could be more literally counterproductive, but that is what fish do. It is a source of unremitting annual distress to the caring pondholder. Every April he is forced to wake from his prelapsarian dream. Once I was God. I dug a hole to create a little world. I looked upon it and saw that it was good. I said, "Be fruitful and multiply." But I shrewdly rested after the 5th day, believing that if I stopped at fish, all would remain innocent. No one was going to offer fish an apple. I didn't know they didn't have to. I didn't know that fish came with built-in sin. I didn't know that when one became fruitful, the other 23 swam round it, waiting for it to multiply, so that they could all tuck in. Well, this year I am putting a stop to it. You can do that if you're God and have a library ticket. I have filleted everything from you and your pond to you and your fish, and under their instruction, I have built a nursery. You might not recognize it as such. It doesn't have Womble wallpaper. It doesn't have a Mickey Mouse mobile. The uninformed would register it as a tin bath full of weeds and walk on. But a nursery is what it is. Somewhere in the weeds is the pregnant fish, poised to lay 1 million eggs. And as soon as she does this, I, as galvanized as the nursery itself, will be on her in a trice, and even as she begins to salivate, will place her on the other side of the loose muslin partition which bisects the bath, go to the pond, select a male, and pop him in beside her. He will then, I am told, begin hurling himself at the muslin, which will allow him to fertilize the eggs, but will not let him through to eat them. Thus, after a bit, I shall have 1 million titchy fish on one side of the curtain, driving their disgusting parents into a gourmand but impotent frenzy. I shall then replace the adult fish in the pond. Fine. But what happens next? The books don't say. I turn the page to find that, like some brusque midwife, they have washed their hands, remounted their rudged bicycles, and pedalled away, leaving me with 1 million infants. Never mind what happens when I plop the parents back in the pond and 22 by now ravenous dinos start shouting, "Where's our bloody lunch?" All that the books say is that baby fish should not be placed in the pond until they are too large to be attacked. Have you any idea what 1 million fish too large to be attacked will look like? Forget the tin bath. I shall need the serpentine. I have thought long and hard about what I have started, and there would seem to be only one way to finish it. I shall ring up Mac Fisheries and tell them that I am in a position to lay my hands on a reliable supply of whitebait. It will be a terrible waste to let all those little fish go uneaten.
A dawn goose.
It would be stretching musicology a bit to describe what cricklewood has as a dawn chorus. It is more of a dawn busk. Each summer day, just as morning brings an arm back to fling its stone into the bowl of light, an ad hoc avian glee club convenes in the sparse urban greenery around my premises and launches into sporadic spasms of whistle and squawk, most of them atonal and none of them loud enough to disturb even the lightest human sleeper. That I know about our early birds at all is only because I have, on occasion, been woken by something else, such as a clunking radiator, and caught, above its plangent bong, a beaky descant from beyond the sash. Until, that is, yesterdawn, when, at 4 a.m, I was torn from sleep by what could only be the blast of a car horn, doubtless some selfish toad hurtling past and loosing one off to feed his joy upon another's pain. But after I'd fallen back onto the pillow, it honked again, same volume. So it wasn't hurtling past at all, it was standing somewhere and leaving me to lie wondering whether to get up and vent a throatful of spleen upon whoever in the street out front was doing it. Impatient eloper, say, nervous getaway driver, 24-hour hooter mechanic, whatever, until it honked a third time. And I realized it wasn't happening in the street out front at all. It was happening at the rear of the house. There was a car in the back garden. Someone, somehow, must have crashed through the fence, trapping himself behind the wheel, and was now attempting to alert the emergency services by the only means available to him. And that, indeed, after I had creaked up, hobbled through to the back of the house and peered out, was, thanks to the half-darkness and the sleep-gummed eye, what I very nearly saw. There was an object on the lawn which might well have been some small foreign job, except that where its wheels should have been were two webbed feet. A small experimental foreign job, perhaps, a little amphibious Japanese number, being secretly tested under cover of British night. But as I watched, the vehicle uncoiled its neck, threw back its head, and honked again. It is somewhat unsettling not only to find an enormous goose on your darkling lawn, but to find it honking, because at 4 a.m. the only thing you can remember about honking geese is that they alerted Rome to invading Gauls. And though you do not, even half awake, immediately conclude that a raiding party of vengeful French farmers is about to sack Cricklewood and make off with its women, you nonetheless cannot help wondering whether some more conventional scallywag might not have breached your defences and even now be going through your spoons. Downstairs, however, I found all secure. So I went out into the garden to tell the dawn soloist to put a sock in it because some of us were trying to get some sleep. But when I approached, waving my arms, instead of retreating, waving its wings, the goose began waddling towards me, giving off a low staccato warbling as if accompanying itself on a muted bugle. Now, if one of the things you can't remember about geese at 4 a.m. is whether they can break a man's arm with a flick of a wing, or is that swans, you back off. And when I did, the goose lurched past me, hopped up the step, and went into the kitchen. I didn't want a goose in my kitchen. Then again, I didn't want my arm in plaster. So I did what any coward would do. I made a deal. I took a slice of bread from the fridge, waggled it at the goose, and went back into the garden. Whither it followed me, and, passing up the opportunity to break my arm, plucked the slice deftly from my hand and ate it. And guess what it did then? It put its head on my knee and let out a low, singularly gentle honk. I didn't know what this meant. I do not have fluent goose, but I have to tell you that as experiences go, it was a bit special. So special, indeed, that I rather believe it has changed my life. Which is why I've told you this tiny tale. Because what we daily share, you and I, is me. And if my life is changed, you have the right to know. And what you should know today is that I shall never eat pâté de foie gras again. Especially not to the sound of trumpets.
After the fox.
I have taken up fox hunting. I know the grisly risks I run in disclosing this intelligence, but I am unable to withhold it. Though I have become unspeakable, in pursuit, ironically, of what is now the only love left which dare not speak its name, I can speak of little else. It is in my blood. Oscar would finally understand. I am no longer my own master. I am master of the Cricklewood hunt. Now, before the more caring among you reach for your balaclavas and pick handles, allow me a few words. It is just possible they may be enough to avert a civil war, and that is a better use for a few words than to elegize one. Think of today's column as the Cricklewood Address. Sunday night was balmy, and balm being precisely what one needs after the spirit-riddling enfilade of the Sunday papers, I took a turn around the garden for that springtime propaganda of hopeful regeneration disseminated by the waft of the wooing blossom and the burp of the rutting frog. And as I sat with soothing fag and tumbler beneath the pear tree beside the pond, I grew gradually aware that I was not alone. First a rustle, could have been a toad, then a sniff, could have been a hedgehog. And finally, when I turned, two yellow eyes. Could have been a cat, until my own irises, adjusting to the dark, suddenly revealed, much in the manner of those magic eye pictures, the outline of a fox. We looked at one another for a bit. It raised its head slightly and sniffed again, but whether because there was too little wind for me usefully to be down of it, or because the fox lacks humankind's topically prissy objections to silk cut and fat 69, it did not move. This was unsettling. I had been led to believe that foxes were more afraid of us than we of them, which has always seemed plausible, given that foxes did not congregate in reinforced toppers and red tailcoats to set about lone citizens engaged on an innocent rural potter. But it was possible that that was then, and this was now. The new urban fox might be a nastier evolution, and in the absence of the ducks and rabbits which elsewhere formed the vulpine diet, fancy a nice bit of man. So I stood up. But the fox merely trotted, unhurriedly, across the lawn towards the narrow gap between houses, which gives access to the road. It gives access, mind, only after, if you are not a fox, you have covered yourself in muck and left half your shirt on a wall nail and half your ear on an air vent. But damage is the huntsman's lot. We do not stop for pain. Out on the street, I saw my quarry turn the corner. It was making for the playing fields opposite. I urged myself into a canter. The fox went under the perimeter fence. The huntsman took it at a bound and a scrabble. A bound and a scrabble and a pratfall on the other side. But no matter, we were both in open country now, the fox at a lope, the huntsman at full gallop. A fine serendipitous sight in the moonlight for any townies setting an alarm clock or flossing teeth, and one glimpsed hitherto only on biscuit tins. I wished, for their sakes, I had a hunting kazoo to blow. For my own, I required only the rushing wind on my face and the pounding of my plimsolled hooves on the dewy grass, the thrill, in short, of the chase. For the fox's sake, however, it went at last to earth, which is what we countrymen call Cricklewood Trading Estate, a place full of floodlit security men, going, "Oi!" from which even the bravest spirit shrinks. So I reined in and turned for home at a steady limp, there to pull off my muddied clothes, elastoplast my sporty wounds, quaff a stirrup cup and lie, exhilarated and exhausted together, at one with Jorrocks's stout opinion that huntin' is all that's worth living for, all toying is lost, what is not spent huntin', it is the hair we breathe. But wondering, and I did promise you a solution for our divided culture, why fox hunting demanded dead foxes? Why not simply gallop after them, behind, if required, muzzled hounds? That surely is where the fun is, if we are not ourselves beasts, and it will be bound to preserve the sport by spiking its opponent's only genuine gun. I do believe I shall try it down here in Cricklewood. All I need is a horse and a decent tailor.
Cricklewood, Cricklewood, you stole my youth away. For I was young and innocent and you were old and grey.
Cor Corran was written and read by Alan Corran and produced by Arid Evans.
For I was young and innocent and you were old and grey.